You are listening to episode 73, Helping Children with Autism and Other Social Communication Challenges with Sarah Whalen.
Welcome to Play Therapy Community Podcast, providing connection, information, and inspiration to child therapists all around the world. Here's your host, a licensed psychotherapist, a registered play therapist, and my mom, Jackie Flynn.
It is important to know that this episode was recorded before COVID-19, so you may hear mention of opportunities no longer available.
So if you know anything about me, you probably know that I absolutely love to read. So years ago, I was reading a book on ADHD by Penny Williams, and as I was reading it, I was like, this is really, really good, and I want to meet this lady. So just on a whim, I searched for her name, and I found an email. I emailed her, and I asked her to be a guest on my podcast, and she was for two times, and since then, we've become really good friends. I love her work, and I just love her personality. She's a good human being. Well, she was such a great support on my innovative child therapy symposium. She does her parenting ADHD and autism summits, and they are phenomenal. Well, through Penny, I met Dr. Sarah Whalen. Oh my goodness. She was also a guest on my innovative child therapy symposium, and it was just such a treat to learn from somebody that's so incredibly knowledgeable, but also so very heartfelt. She's a certified relationship development intervention consultant, a parent coach. She does different talks, and she's also a special needs caregiver. And today's episode really explores autism spectrum disorder in the brain. She's a wealth of knowledge. Since I met her, we've become Facebook friends, and she posts a lot of pictures of nature. I think she really likes nature, but she also loves the brain. So she recently posted a picture of the polyvagal theory poster that she has that I'm so in awe of. I think I'm going to buy one. But she's just crazy about anything and everything that can be supportive to our families that are really navigating the world of autism spectrum disorder. And she's also in Penny Williams Summit. They work together with these parenting ADHD and autism summits. So if you haven't checked out those, they are wonderful. I'm actually going to be a guest speaker on their next one at the time of this recording. But I just wanted to give you a heads up, prepare to be inspired as we listen to my conversation with Sarah Wayland. This episode is brought to you by EMDR and Play Therapy Integration Support. Are you an EMDR trained therapist that works with children and teens? I'd love to help you integrate play therapy techniques throughout all 8 phases so that your child and teen clients can fully experience the immense healing power of EMDR therapy. Visit JackieFlynnConsulting.com to check out my free webinars, EMDRIA-approved courses, certification opportunities, case consultation options, individual and group, and much more. Children are not miniature adults, so working with them in a developmentally appropriate way can make a world of difference. Again, visit JackieFlynnConsulting.com.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Jackie.
Hey, thank you so much for being on the Play Therapy Community Podcast. I recently met you through the Innovative Child Therapy Symposium and through Penny Williams, one of my favorite authors in the entire world. And I'm super excited to have you here today.
Well, I'm so excited you invited me to talk.
Oh, of course. It's my honor. Now, let me have you tell people who you are and what you do.
So my name is Sarah Wayland. I do three different things. One is I do something called special needs care navigation, and that's working with parents to help them figure out what's up with their kids who are having troubles in school or at home. The second thing is I do something called Relationship Development Intervention. That is a parent coaching program where we work with the parents of kids with autism to help them do what we call restore the guiding relationship, and then to help the kids learn to develop flexible dynamic thinking. But it's a parent coaching model, so I basically am coaching the parents to do that work with their kids. And then the third thing I do is just parent coaching for people who don't have kids with autism or who just want to talk to somebody about what they're experiencing and brainstorm ideas for how to help. So those are the three things I do. I live and work in Maryland, just outside of Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And I also am the co-host with Penny Williams of the Parenting Summit online. What is it? The Parenting Autism Summit. And there we've interviewed now over 50 experts on autism about things that parents might need to know about autism.
Yeah, I think that's just unbelievable, the amount of free resources that you guys have to really educate parents. It's incredible. And I think some of the most just beneficial information that I got from you, especially from your interview on my summit, was like both of you guys, you know, like you're not just teaching and you're not just giving out information. You're living it. And you know from experience, like you have some real world, true world experiences, some real life things that you apply these things to. And I've learned so much from both of you guys. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. I have to say the real life stuff keeps me humble. That's for sure. 'Cause I think, oh, I know how to do this. And then I am so wrong.
Oh, that's funny. That I know I have a gazillion personal experiences. I remember even just a pacifier. I remember when I was pregnant with my son, I was like, I don't need a pacifier. I'm going to be one of those parents that their baby doesn't need a pacifier. On the way from the hospital, we were stopping by the department store and getting like 10 pacifiers. Like it does knock you down a couple of notches to where you can be humble. It's funny. So in today's discussion, which I am so excited about, I feel like this is definitely an area that isn't really covered in grad school for a lot of mental health professionals. And we're going to be talking all about just helping children with autism and other social communication challenges. And I know you said that you'd share with us like just a brief overview of the biology of autism, some of the core challenges, and how there can be some misinterpretations from people, and what clinicians and parents can do to help.
That sounds great.
I'm excited. Let's jump right into like the biology of autism. Tell us about that.
Okay, so one of the things that I think is really important to remember, you know, autism is tough because it's an invisible disability. So when you look at somebody with autism, you don't think, oh, that kid's got something going on. It's not obvious until you do something and they respond in a way that's unexpected. You really might not realize what's going on. And so unfortunately, because it's an invisible disability, a lot of times people with autism get blamed for their behaviors that is actually a direct result of their underlying biology. So I do like to start by just explaining like some of what those biological differences are. So so I'll just dive into that. But in order to talk about the biology, I want to do just a brief overview of what learning is about and how that happens in the neural pathways in your brain. Ooh. So when you're a little baby, one of the things that's happening up through about, toddler years, is that your brain is developing a lot of connections. So, you know, synapses, lots of connections between neurons and so on. You have the most neurons in your brain that you will ever have in your life around the age of 2 years. And what happens is when you use a particular pathway, then that gets reinforced and the other connections start dying off. And so what happens is the things you're learning can then travel more quickly because they have less detours they might go on. So as your brain prunes more and more of those neural connections away, then your ability to do a task that you need to do a lot, and one example is learning language, learning how to speak a language, then it gets easier and easier as those excess synapses go away, and you know the ones you're actually using stay in place, and then you can develop those to make stronger connections. Mm-hmm. And so that's how typical development works. The problem with autism is that the kids come to the world with different structures to their neurons and the connections between those neurons. So just starting with an autistic neuron, then if you look at the axon coming out of the neuron, the nodes on the axon, there are many, many more in an autistic brain. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you have a toddler with all those connections, well, kids with autism have even more connections. Mm-hmm. And so they have more ways to take a wrong turn and, you know, go off and not make the connection they need to make. So that's a pretty well-known finding. A second thing that happens is that around those axons, there is something called the myelin sheath. Mm-hmm. And that the thicker the myelin sheath, the more quickly that impulse travels down the axon. And in a non-autistic brain, that myelin sheath is it's pretty thick. Like it's almost, you know, as thick as the axon is round. Mm-hmm. But in the autistic brain, very often you'll have thinner myelin sheaths. So the neural impulse is going to travel more slowly. And I actually just read a paper last week that said that even that's too simple, that in some people with autism, it's thinner, but in some people with autism, it's thicker, which makes it so the impulse goes so quickly that they can't stop it before they do it. So, and that actually raises a point I do want to make sure your listeners understand, which is it isn't autism, it's autisms. There are lots, I view autism as a symptom of something going on. And I think we talk about cancer, there are lots of different kinds of cancer, and not that autism is a disease, but we have this big word, but there are lots of different underlying reasons for that particular type of presentation.
So Sarah, would it, just as far as the phrasing, so what I'm hearing you saying is it can look different with, or people experience it differently, even just that the myelin sheath is different, which, and there's probably other ways that it's different for a variety of people as well. Would it be correct to say autism spectrum disorders, like an autism spectrum disorder, telling that there's more than one?
Yeah. So that's my view, but I suspect when you communicate with other people, uh-huh. they might be like, why are you putting that S on there? Mm-hmm. So, you know, in the DSM, you know, you have these different levels. So you have level one, which is, people who are less obviously autistic. And then, you know, it goes down to level three, which is people who are profoundly impacted by autism. And mm-hmm. it's pretty clear just looking at them that they're having a hard time. So, so I think that's
a continuum.
Yeah, the DSM's tried to capture those differences, mm-hmm. but I do see patterns. So there's certain types of autism, you know, and I see, you know, exemplars of, you know, oh, this is this type, this is another type, you know. So mm-hmm. there are certain characteristics that do seem to travel together, but I have been looking for work on that, and people are curious about it, but it's definitely, you know, that's, there's some interesting stuff to be done there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It sounds like you can't just say this is what a person with autism spectrum disorder is struggling with. It could be what one person is struggling with, but another person may be totally different in their experience based on
just the biology of it is just one variable. It sounds like there's probably many other variables like environment or experiences, things like that.
Exactly. Exactly. And you've brought up an important point, which is, you know, people are always asking, like, what causes autism? And the answer is that there are lots of different underlying things that can cause brain development to go awry. And so environment is certainly one feature. There's genetics. So, you know, that you can usually see in families that the genetics, you know, travels. You just like, you know, if you see autism in one part of the family, you may well see it in another part of the family. Mm-hmm. So it's a complex interaction between the genetics and the environment. So there's also some work showing that, you know, people might have a propensity to develop autism, but unless they're exposed to some environmental factor that triggers it, they might not develop it.
I think you just touched on something that I've seen over the years, like people are very curious about what causes it, you know, in some way. Some people tend to blame themselves. It must have been something that I did or something that I didn't do during pregnancy. And I don't think it's different than that. It's not something that somebody did right or did wrong. It's more of just, you know, development.
Yeah. And it definitely, yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, there's no blame here. It just, you know,
mm-hmm. Yeah, that's where education is important, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I certainly know that in my case, I have two children with autism. I forgot to mention that in the introduction. But I know I certainly went through a long period of wondering what I had done wrong, you know, to make my children have to struggle with this. But then when I started going through my family tree, I was like, yeah.
Yeah, is it not your
parent? Uncle Joe? So,
and that thought of parent blame, my goodness, that's a painful piece that isn't necessarily even accurate, and people are suffering with kind of carrying that when it's not even something that is, you know, true.
It's not true, but even in, you know, cases where it is true, I always say people are doing the best they can with the information they have at the time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's so good. Can you repeat that?
Sure. People are doing the best they can with the information they have at that time.
Oh, so good. So good. Yeah. Even when especially when we make mistakes, as all of us do, or choices that lead us down a path that's unexpected, you know, when we know better, we do better, Maya Angelou says. But yeah, do the best they can with what the information they have at the time. That's so good. I'm going to put that in the show notes.
Okay.
So in terms of like biology, you talk to us a lot about like the connections and in the right brain. Anything else that's important to know about that?
Yeah. So there are a couple of other things. So I've been talking about the neurons themselves. And, you know, the fact that they may be developing in a different way than it does in a non-autistic brain. But there are also different areas in the brain that specialize in different things. So, you know, for example, we know the occipital cortex processes visual information, auditory cortex, oral information. And the prefrontal cortex, it turns out in autism, tends to have a lot of interconnectedness in it, but not so many connections between the prefrontal cortex and the rest of the brain. So in non-autistic brains, what you'll see is that there's a lot of connection between the frontal lobes. And this, I'm talking about adults here, mm-hmm. Because that's something that develops as you're maturing through childhood. What happens in adulthood is that there are fewer connections in the autistic brain. And so it's harder for the prefrontal cortex to tell different areas of the brain, hey, you need to come online now, you know, all right, we need to pay attention to this signal that's happening right here or whatever. Mm-hmm. And in the autistic brain, it's harder to get that message from the prefrontal cortex to whatever area it's trying to talk to, because there are just fewer connections.
Mm-hmm.
And one more difference is, and this is kind of silly technical, but it's actually really profound. In the cortex of the brain, it organizes itself into layers. And so if you take a slice through the outer part of the brain and look at the structure, you can see that the neurons organize themselves so that, you know, one type of connection is happening at one level, a different at the next level, and so on. And they're very distinctive looking layers when you look at them. And if you look at the brains of people with autism, you don't see those. You have these patches where those layers are not happening. Mm-hmm. And so they're just, you know, we call it disorganized, you know, in neurology, they call it a, you know, disorganized patches. But, you know, I like to call it a difference. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely not in those layered fashion. So you'll see these chunks where it's just not organized that way. And so the signal is not as clearly processed. So it's literally like being processed differently than it is in the non-autistic brain. So these are very profound biological differences we're talking about here, even though people with autism may look just like anyone else. What's going on in their brains and also in the signals traveling out to parts of their body is actually quite different.
Mm-hmm. And when you say it's an invisible disorder, like you can't tell just by looking at them, but there's some very real things that are different in their brain, and it results in different behaviors, different ways they approach the world, functionality and everything.
Yeah. And, you know, when I was talking, I was just thinking about what you were just saying there. And, you know, when I talked about the thinner myelin sheath and, you know, the signal just traveling not as quickly. A lot of people with autism also have motor control issues. So they're kind of clumsy. And that's because literally the signal is traveling slower, you know, to the different parts of their body. So walking is just a little more effort for them because the signal never gets as fast as it does for somebody without autism. And you'll see that reflected in things like their ability to speak. And, you know, just the motor control required to speak is, it's an amazing process. So, that, you know, that any of us learn it is pretty miraculous, but in autism, it can really, get impaired by these slower nerve transmission speeds.
Mm-hmm. Wow. It could affect every area of their life, it sounds like.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I think when we think about like parenting or for clinicians that are working with children with an autism spectrum disorder or teachers, it's really important to have this information just on the differences in the biology, because it's not necessarily something that they're doing right or doing wrong. They're doing what their body is allowing them to do. I mean, we train them, but it's not that they're misbehaving or anything like that.
Exactly. Exactly. And that can be sometimes hard for people to really understand, is that the person is truly doing the best they can with what they have.
Oh, that applies across the board.
Yes, it does.
That is so good. Us as parents, children, just, you know, trying to function with all the struggles that they may have been given, and teachers, educators, clinicians, we're all just doing the best we can with what we have.
Yep. So I thought next I would just talk about how this plays out. You know, so what it looks like when you're interacting with somebody with autism, like what some of the challenges are, for those folks.
Okay.
So the first thing that people often talk about, and this is actually coming to be kind of controversial, but for a long time, people thought one of the core challenges with autism was difficulty with what they call theory of mind. Mm-hmm. And I actually prefer to call it theory of other people's minds. Mm. Because what's going on there is that the person with autism has a hard time understanding that somebody else might have different information than they have, and, you know, may therefore need you to you know, behave differently. So a really common thing, and you'll see this in young kids too, where they just think that they don't understand that their parents are not an extension of them, that they are, you know, they have their own experiences and their own perspective on the world. And it takes a while for young kids to learn that. And it takes longer for people with autism to learn that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of that is because their brains are literally wired in a different way. And so, you know, if you have a kid who's like, you know, fantastically good at mathematics, I'll just take as an example, and they're interacting with somebody else who maybe isn't so good at math, they're like, how could you not know math? Like, what's with that? That doesn't make any sense to me, because they can't fathom what it would be like to not be good at math.
Like, and see out of their own experience, be able to just kind of imagine what it would like to be something different than what they're experiencing, their reality.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the classic tests they use for theory of mind is they have this thing called the Sally Ann scenario, where you have two puppets, and, you know, one is Sally and one is Ann, and they have a box that's between them. And Sally puts a ball in the box while Ann is watching, and then Ann leaves the room, and Sally pulls the ball out of the box and goes and hides it somewhere else. And then Ann comes back into the room, and you ask the child who's been watching this, where does Ann think the ball is? The child with autism will say, it's, you know, behind the pillar over there, because they think that Ann knows everything they know. The person who has theory of mind is going to realize that Ann did not see Sally move that ball. And so they're going to say, oh, Ann's going to look in the box for the ball.
They're able to kind of look at it through a deeper lens, like to be able to understand somebody else's experience.
Exactly. And that's something that can be hard for people with autism. And what's doubly hard, it's funny because I kind of like to joke that people without autism have terrible theory of mind for people with autism. So I think a lot of it is that, you know, we have our way of seeing the world, and it's hard for us to conceive that other people are having a different way of thinking about the world.
It's like a higher level thinking, like to be able to conceptualize that somebody else has a different reality than ours.
Yeah. And it gets really basics. This theory of mind stuff plays out in really basic ways. So one of the things you'll see sometimes in people with autism is difficulty with gender. So they'll use the wrong pronouns, like everybody's a he, or, you know, they have a hard time with that. And that makes their communication confusing. Or, you know, they'll talk about, you know, trying to explain where something is. They'll say, oh, it's, you know, on the left, when they're facing the person, and that person's left is, you know, on the autistic person's right. And so, right, you have to adjust for how that person is facing, you know.
And that could look like on the surface that they just don't know their directions right and left, which would be totally inaccurate. They do. They're just, it's that theory of mind. So their perception, it is on the left because it's on their left.
Exactly.
Wow. Exactly.
Yeah. So that, as you can imagine, that would lead to being confused by linguistics, you know, things that happen. Like when we're communicating with each other, there are all these subtle aspects to language that come back to this theory of mind issue that make it really hard for them to understand what you're trying to tell them. And it leads to a lot of confusion and crossed wires.
I could see where if someone didn't know that, if they weren't aware of just that whole concept of theory of mind, maybe an educator or just a parent, just regular daily life stuff comes up, and it may look like they just don't understand something, or they're and it's something totally different. That's just another illustration of how important education is to be able to learn about what they're struggling with and how they struggle with it, so that you can then address that issue, whether it's through, like, actually, you know, I'm talking about if you were to look at it as that other person. I know in a lot of the social skills groups, or just working with a kid, you can teach them strategies.
Right, right, Right. And very often, if you can point out to them what's going on, they can reason their way through it. They just need somebody to point it out to them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a matter of, you know, just making them aware that this is a challenge. But you know, what you'll have is you'll have these kids who get really angry at people for not understanding their perspective on things.
Yeah. And,
you know, how did you not know I needed to go to the bathroom? You know, and it's like, uh-huh. Well.
And that presents itself. I mean, it could look like the person's irritable, self-centered. It could look like they, and it could, you know, definitely affect peer relations, like their ability to make friends and to have healthy relationships is just another struggle that they experience, and just being, you know, in families that deal with that.
You bet. You bet. And I'll tell you another core challenge that actually does get miscoded again as being clueless and selfish. So people with autism, so there are, I don't know if you've talked about polyvagal theory in any of your podcasts.
Oh, yes. Guess what? I get to see Deb Dana's presentation in 3 weeks. I'm going to spend a whole day listening to her about the polyvagal theory. So like window of tolerance and things like that. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah. Lucky you. That sounds great.
I can't wait. I'm going to be like starstruck just as you start talking.
Wow. I'm so jealous.
But the polyvagal theory, really just picking up on those, even like the way that the corner of our mouth goes while we're talking, or how our expressions in our eyes, those little cues, those little social nuances can really impact, like people pick up on them, but not so much if they have an autism spectrum disorder, right?
Well, that's right. And so, and that's getting at, you know, visual processing of information. So for example, people without autism will look in someone's eyes, you know, or look at the way their eyes are, you know, moving, or where they're looking, you know, maybe how their eyebrows are, you know, forehead, things like that, like information about the face in the person they're talking to get information about how they are behaving and how that might be landing with that person. But people with autism, just because of the way they're wired, one thing that happens is sometimes the auditory signal is hard for them to process. So they'll have something that's like what's called central auditory processing disorder. And it just means it's harder to separate the sounds, you know, in the environment from the sounds coming out of somebody's mouth. And so it's hard for them to attend to that. So often they will actually look at the person's mouth to help disambiguate what they're hearing. So they're focusing on the lips and how the lips are moving so they can understand what that person is saying. And they miss all these other cues that are in the face, you know, around the eyes and forehead and so on. And so they don't notice what's going on with that person and how what they're saying is landing emotionally. So they can look very clueless about that.
Almost like uncaring, or like I'm thinking in cases of where parents sometimes unknowingly, you know, say, look at me, you know, and they may, you know, be demanding that eye-to-eye contact when the kid is just trying to figure out what's going on, looking at the person's lips and everything.
Right. And actually, you know, people with autism often report that looking at someone's eyes is actually makes it impossible to process anything else, because your eyes actually move a lot while you're talking. They move, you know, they're constantly moving because you're looking at the person, you're looking around. Like, you know, eye contact is kind of a misnomer. I like to call it facial gazing. That, you know, looking at somebody's face is how we process what, you know, what, how things are landing. But we've coded that as eye contact. And so if you say to somebody with autism, you know, look me in the eye, I mean, my older son will say to me, I can either look at your eyes, or I can listen to you, but I cannot do both.
Ah, and that, I mean, he has words for it, but many, especially younger kids, they don't. It can send them out of their window of tolerance really quick.
Exactly. So yeah, you know, with polyvagal theory, so Stephen Porges actually has an article on polyvagal theory as an explanation for what autism is that I have to tell you rings really true to me. And what he says is it's basically a challenge in regulating your sympathetic and parasympathetic systems, you know, in the way you need to deal with whatever situation is presenting. So, you know, what tends to happen.
That's so good. Just kind of repeat that so we could get a double take. See, okay. Stephen Porges said.
He says that regulating the sympathetic and the parasympathetic systems, you know, they're always operating in, you know, as a balance to prepare you for a particular situation. So, you know, if you're being chased by a tiger, then that sympathetic system is going to be super activated. Mm-hmm. And what happens in autism is, you know, maybe like you're in a classroom and you need to pay attention. So you're going to, you know, suppress the parasympathetic system a little bit and activate the sympathetic system a bit so you can pay attention and so on. But they have a harder time regulating in that continuous way. So it might be all, you know, one or all the other. So they move between fight and flight or freeze, you know, which is overactive parasympathetic system. And they move between those in a much less fluid way than people without autism.
Wow. That piece of information, I feel like, demystifies a lot of it.
Yeah.
To where people can, you know, tease out, is this a disorder or is this a behavior? Is this something that, you know, how would I respond to it in a way that's going to help the child learn or help them do something differently?
Yeah. And because they trip into those modes so quickly, it can be very hard to teach them how to modulate that. And again, remember that modulation is biological. So it's harder for them to learn those skills of modulating those systems. And I, you know, there's a lot of thought in autism land now that just being autistic exposes you on a daily basis to trauma. And so, you know, just being in the world is traumatizing. Because you're shifting into this fight or flight or freeze. And so, you know, if it gets too loud for you and me, that might be fun. You know, you go to a festival or something and you're listening to loud music. But for the person with autism who's sensitive to auditory stimulation or too much movement and crowds, that might just trip them straight into, you know, some kind of trauma response. So things that we think are fun for them are traumatizing. And because we don't realize that, we're constantly exposing them to situations they can't handle.
And I have to say, like what you just said, things that we think are fun, they are like traumatized by it. I think, you know, a lot of times as a therapist, parents will be so confused and like, why wouldn't they like this? I loved Disney World when I was a kid.
Yes. Or,
they're so ungrateful. They have way more than I had when I was a child. And the birthday party was all for them. And they still, I can't believe they did that. And it goes so much deeper than that. And I think, you know, it goes right back to people are doing the best they can with what they have. I love that you're out there teaching parents that this isn't necessarily a representation of just disrespect or anything like
right.
that. It's more of, they just are overstimulated, overwhelmed. They are, you know, that theories of mind concept. They are not perceiving things in the way that we perceive things. It's a different reality that they're experiencing.
It sure is. And this is a really hard thing for parents particularly to understand. I see it all the time where they think the child is being disrespectful. Mm-hmm. And you know, I have some mantras for parenting. One of them is quit taking it personally.
Oh, that's yeah, so good. It. That's like the four agreements, one of the
four. right. But, you know, so many parents think the kid is defying them when, in fact, what's really going on is the kid is just trying to figure out how to regulate, you
yeah.
know, in whatever situation they're in. And it may not be so functional because they're kids. But it's not, you know, they're not trying to, you know, get your goat. They're really trying to do the best they can. And then when you come after them and say, hey, you're being disrespectful, the kid feels so misunderstood. It's so hard. So hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that right there, feeling misunderstood, even one occurrence of that can feel heavy, two occurrences, but life is hard. I think we were talking about this before we hit record. Life can get really hard. And when there's patterns of feeling misunderstood, sometimes it just looks like somebody's just giving up. Like yeah. It just feels hopeless. And these kids, you know, they have limited life experience. So they don't have a lot to base it on in terms of like, oh, things will get better. Or this is just, right. You know, all of that is out the window. It just feels like a difficult, low quality of life if these concepts really aren't understood.
Yeah. So I want to touch on a few sort of what are considered the core challenges real quick, because I know we're running out of time.
Okay.
So one of the challenges is something called joint attention, which is just the fact that when you're paying attention to something, the people who are with you might find what you're attending to interesting too. So the example I always like to use is, you know, if I was sitting and talking to you and all of a sudden I turned and looked out the window, you would think, oh, she just saw something out that window. I better look out there, right? That's a very natural response. But people with autism who don't have that joint attention skill don't understand that what I'm looking at might hold useful information for them. Mm. So that's a very basic one that's developed very early in young babies. Joint attention, you know, starts developing, you know, within the first few months of life. And so, you know,
kids with autism, when I think about that joint attention, have you seen the still face experiment where,
yes.
Oh, that reminds me of that. Like, babies need that. That's not even something that's like fun or just optional. They need that for development.
Well, you bet. And this connection piece is, I mean, that's what you need for development. Like, you need connection. It's the core thing. And what's so devastating about autism is the lack of these skills like joint attention or social referencing, which I'll talk about in a second. But when you don't have those, you lose the ability to feel connected, which then has profound repercussions for your development. And it's why autism is such a devastating condition.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So I mentioned social referencing just a minute ago, and social referencing is the ability to evaluate the reaction of a trusted person. So, you know, if you see something new and unfamiliar, an example I've heard is, you know, if you if you find poop, like, you know, let's say your cat like scoops, you know, swats some poop out of their cat box or something, and you see that, like, you have a reaction, ew, gross, you know, and you won't touch it, you know, you'll get your little scooper thing and put it away, and then you'll wash the floor where it fell, and you know, you treat it like it's something disgusting, and your children learn that from you. So they say, oh, you know, when I see something, you know, on the floor like that, I should treat it as disgusting and, you know, clean it up and make sure that all the germs are gone and so on. And so they take their reaction based on what they see you reacting with.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's it's a very good we do, not as we say.
Right. That's right. That's right. And that is a really fundamental skill for children to learn from their parents is, you know, okay, I take their reaction and use it as my reaction. And that social referencing is just so important. And it leads to co-regulation or reciprocity, which is just taking these small adaptive actions to stay connected with the people we're talking with. So, you know, I was talking earlier about facial gazing and looking at how your communications land with that person. Co-regulation is you do something, you see how it lands on that other person, and, you know, they'll respond in some way. And then you're going to have a response, which might be, you know, if you see it landed badly, maybe you'll make a repair to make, you know, to try to make sure the person is not feeling upset with you or whatever. And that back and forth, just that back and forth action of coordinating, serve and return, is so important. And it's that one, I will tell you, every kid with autism I work with struggles with co-regulation. It is a core difficulty. And a lot of these kids have trouble, you know, joint attention. Some of them have it, some of them don't. Social referencing, fewer of them have it, but there are still plenty who do. Co-regulation in almost every instance is hard for people with autism.
Yeah, when you say co-regulation is so dependent. I don't want to say dependent, but influenced by like those pieces of the polyvagal theory, then be able to kind of pick up on little cues. And I know, like, as therapists, we're trained to really connect with the clients through our body language and things of that nature. If they struggle with picking up on those things, then they're going to be limited with their capacity to even, you know, benefit from those co-regulation efforts. That's such a good point that you make. It's just another limitation that we got to figure out a way to work around.
Right. And, you know, one thing you'll see, you know, I talk about, you know, autisms. And one of the things I will say is that some people with autism are super, super mega sensitive to the emotional tone of what's going on around them. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are. They're very tuned into it. But what they don't realize is that they can have an impact on that. So they don't understand where it's coming from. So, for example, if I just, you know, said something really mean to you and you started crying and you didn't understand that what I just said to you made you cry, you would just think, wow, like Jackie just burst into tears at random moments, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's one of the things that's super hard for people with autism to navigate, is they feel like other people are having emotions and they have no idea why they're having them. And in fact, one of my favorite theories of autism is called autism as context blindness. Peter Vermeulen has a book by that same title. And basically what he says is it's really hard for them to take all the contextual cues into account to help explain what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and if that's one of your struggles, to be able to take those contextual cues and kind of process through them, then it's going to look very different. Can you say the title of that one more time? I'm going to put it in the show notes so people can go to check out that book or purchase.
Of course. That. Yeah, Peter Vermeulen, and I think it's Vermeulen, and his book is called Autism as Context Blindness.
Oh, okay. Wow. I hadn't heard of that book, but that seems like that's right, exactly aligned with what we're talking about. It's like many times, you know, if you don't have this information, we expect these kids to automatically get something, to act in a certain way that their brain isn't necessarily designed to be able to do. And understanding those struggles and what they're blind to, it can help us kind of react a different way, but also go into what can help with that. Now, we're almost out of time, but I know you said you were going to talk about what we could do to help. Is there like a quickie version of the what we can do to help, like 5 minutes or so?
Sure. I mean, so one of the things, you know, I was talking about with the biology is, you know, how hard it is to establish a working pathway, right? And so one of the things, you know, people with autism absolutely can learn these skills, but it's going to take them longer. So we need to be patient with them. So, you know, a few strategies that I really like, my favorite one is slowing down. So when you say something, you know, expect your kid, you know, to do something, put on your shoes, mm-hmm. like just stop one thing at a time, stop, and then give them time to process that. And then go put on their shoes. So, you know, our society, we're so busy and it's, you know, we've got a lot to do. We got to get to work in the morning and our kids are learning, you know, these skills. And so any kid is going to, you know, benefit from a little patience and extra time. People with autism need more time. And so very often what happens to them is when you are pressing them to go faster than they can go is when they shut down and have a hard time. So just being calm. So that's the other thing is from you, like you know, we talk about co-regulation, and one of my other phrases I always talk about is, you know, your kids are borrowing your calm. And so, you know, if you can stay calm, that's how they're going to learn to self-regulate, right, is through your own regulation. And that's part of co-regulation. And that's why co-regulation precedes the development of self-regulation. But
that's so good. If we're not calm, then it's going to activate them. I love that. Right. Be the thermostat, not the thermometer. If we get really overheated and this is just going to get worse.
But I've never heard that. I love it.
Yeah, it's true. Once I heard that, I was like, okay, I'm going to be the thermostat too. And I actually have that in my office where I actually went and bought a thermostat and I have a thermometer and we talk about the differences. It's like that so valuable, even though it's hard in the moment. I believe Penny Williams did a little parenting video on this too. Being able to just cool it down as things get hotter can actually help your kids to cool it down. But it's a tall order. It's not easy.
No. Definitely not easy, and partly because we are wired to respond in kind. And so if you have a little person having a big reaction, we are wired to respond in kind, and it doesn't help them. So it is really
somehow with your own kids, things kind of seem a little bit more activating than with other kids. I know when mine were little, like at church or in the store, it seemed like such a huge deal. Like everybody's looking at us and this is inconvenience and everybody. Even now I'm out and about and I see parents going through struggle and I actually like have compassion. I'm like, oh, they're having a hard day right now. You know, it's not nearly the impact as I imagined it to be when I was on the other end. And I think that's important for parents to keep in mind that, you know, people are not as inconvenienced by your life, by your kid having a tantrum as you think they may be.
Yeah. And you know, what's interesting about that point is that unfortunately, so you're having that compassionate response. And I think most people are having that compassionate response, but there's sometimes these people who are not having a compassionate response and they often feel free to speak out and tell you how they're feeling about what's going on. And so then the parents feel judged, which is really hard.
Yeah. I've heard that too. Like I would whip his butt, you know, and they don't say butt, you know, and it's like, it's really hard. I know that's across the board, not even just with autism spectrum disorder.
Right.
It's hard to be a parent, with a client with or a child with exceptionalities because of people that don't live that life. It's kind of like that theory of mind. They just don't know how hard it is. They don't know the sacrifices and the struggles and what that entails just to get out the door and get to school on time, much less to a day at Disney World or something.
Right. I had a friend I worked with and he had two young kids, totally typically developing kids. And he got to work one day and he just looked at me and said, I just put in a whole day's work getting here.
That says it all. Just to get the shoes on and get out the door and hopefully get there on time. It's a big one. Well, we're out of time, but I want to make sure people know where to find you and how to get your services because you are such an incredible gift to the world.
No, well, thank you, Jen.
And I truly mean that. You have so much to offer. Just a piece on the biology of the brain. I was tempted to Google, but I didn't want to mess up the audio for this recording. Google the brain and see what those images look like. I may try to find something and attach in the show notes so people have a visual.
Well, I have a PowerPoint. I could just make a PDF of that and give it to you. So,
oh, that'd be great. We'll put that in as the free download. So if you're listening to this and you would like Dr. Whalen's download of the PowerPoint, just visit playtherapycommunity.com and search for her Dr. Whalen's episode.
Okay. And you can find me at Guiding Exceptional Parents is the name of my company. And my website is guidingexceptionalparents.com. And I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter, LinkedIn. I just started Pinterest. So you can find me all those places.
Yeah. So you're on Pinterest. That's awesome. I literally used to go to Pinterest every day. Now I've cut it back to like twice a week.
Yeah. rein yourself in.
Rein it in. It's so good. I love that platform to get quick little ideas. One of the things I search for quite frequently there is art therapy techniques. I think I search that about my 2 times a week. There's so many different ideas on art therapy techniques and play therapy techniques and things like that. So now that I know that you're on there, I'm going to be searching for you too.
Well, I don't have any art therapy stuff. I actually love Pinterest for that kind of stuff. But yeah, it's man, I could see how helpful that would be. What a great idea for that.
Yeah, yeah. So yours is pinterest.com/guidingexceptionalparents. Twitter is twitter.com/parenting/parent guiding. All of these links, LinkedIn, Facebook, we'll have that all in the show notes.
Okay, good.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Whalen.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate being here and it was fun to talk to you.
Oh, I appreciate it. It's my honor. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Play Therapy Community Podcast. Be sure to check out the show notes for this episode and explore our growing members library of play therapy related resources at www.playtherapycommunity.com. Prepare to be informed, equipped, inspired, and supported.